Borag Thung, Earthlitz, I'm sure you will have heard by now the very sad news that veteran 2000 AD and Judge Dredd artist Ron Smith has passed away. Originally destined for a life as an engineer, it was World War II and his call-up to fly Spitfires that saw Ron eventually move into animation. And then, to our great credit, into comics, working for the Amalgamated Press, then DC Thompson, before moving to IPC and 2000 AD. During the 1980s heyday of 2000 AD, he was one of the great iconic Dredd artists, alongside the likes of Carlos Esquerda, Mick McMahon, Brian Bolland and Steve Dillon. And many of the strip's most unforgettable moments, from the Judge Dredd quest to Chopper in Un-American Graffiti, from the Hot Dog Run to The Day the Law Died, have the name and unmistakable style of Ron Smith stamped all over them. Not just that, but he was also the artist behind the Daily Star newspaper strip, one of the longest running in British newspaper history, which showcased Judge Dredd and his talents to a whole new mainstream audience. On this episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about Ron's work and his legacy and some of our favourite moments from a career spanning 50 years. There's so much we could talk about, so we've kept it relatively focused onto 2000 AD and Judge Dredd. But it's safe to say that 2000 AD has lost another of its most beloved artists. Ron had retired many years ago, but he's still very sorely missed by everybody at 2000 AD. And I'm joined in the sound booth by current editor of 2000 AD, Matt Smith.
Hello.
And on Skype, we have former art editor and art droid, Robin Smith.
Hello.
And former Tharg, Steve McManus.
Howdy.
So, guys, what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about your experience of working with Ron, because, I mean, his career spanned 50 years of British comic books, but at 2000 AD, he was surrounded by all these young Turks. You know, you had Mick McMahon, you had Brian Bolland, people like that, but here was this sort of well-dressed silver fox who was amongst it. There's a wonderful photograph of a signing from the 1980s where you've got Bolland, you've got Wagner, a couple of others, and then Ron Smith, and it could not be more chalk and cheese. So, Robin, I wanted to come to you first to ask what your experience and your memories of Ron were.
Well, first of all, that photograph always makes me think of the small faces meeting somebody from the Jazz Age. Yeah, no, Ron, when he started on 2000, it just kind of like, it was like he'd been wanting to do that for years. Instantly started doing Dredd fantastically. And it's the amount he put in it that was so astonishing. He was obviously an experienced artist, but it was almost like it was a new lease of life. He was doing the stuff he really wanted to do from the look of it.
He'd been doing so much stuff he worked for both IPC and DC Thompson, but a lot of it was your kind of stock kind of action adventure series. And then he did King Cobra for DC Thompson, and that was very American looking.
Well, I think Ron told me that I don't know whether he actually did some work for America. I know he really liked him, but that was the surprise. I didn't realise how familiar he was with American comics, because I thought he was just hanging out the sort of British tradition. But it turns out, yeah, he was. So, he'd looked at a lot of American stuff. So, yeah, he brought some of that to it as well. Mm. But with the intensity of drawing and the amount of detail that you used to see in old British comics, you know, if you look at the old Valiant, 12-page pictures a page, He did that sort of, he put that much work into it.
As art editor, what was your experience of working with Ron? Because he worked a lot via agents so that he could get on with the business of drawing. But what was your interaction with him?
Well, the thing is, you didn't have to really do much with Ron. I mean, if on the occasions that I met or spoke to Ron, you'd end up talking about, he'd tell you the best stories about his early days at DC Thompson, some of which were absolutely fantastic. And you ended up talking about other things, because the thing is about the artwork, he did it perfectly, and you never had to change anything. I can't remember, I mean, Steve will tell this, I can't remember ever having to change anything that Ron did. His artwork came in, it was camera ready, it was clean. Maybe you cleaned up the occasional gutter or something, but it was always right. So when you talk to him, it was more social than business, really, in most cases. You know, you maybe talk about a story or a cover or something, but that was as far as it went.
Steve, what was your experience? Was it the same from when you were working with Ron?
I was just trying to think how he sort of came upon the scene, as it were. I think he came out of the left field, really. His agent must have brought some samples in, which I imagine were Dredd samples, or Ron asked his agent to bring them in. But apart from that, I never saw the guy. He never came up to the office, as I can remember, because he had an agent, and Ron was very money-focused, I think. You know, his time was precious. In fact, I think the only time I met him was at that signing, which you just referred to. So that's my experience of, quote, working with him.
Didn't we go out for lunch with his, when he first started, with his agent? And it was the old, was it Temple, his agent?
Yeah.
Do you remember the old guy that had retired that we hardly used to see? He was there.
Yeah.
Went out for lunch, don't you remember? And he just had a stomach ulcer that had burst, and that was the story for the lunch. Which, I know, we were all, well, it was, he made it a funny story, but that's the fun. I remember meeting Ron, because it's something you don't quite forget.
Yeah, there were a fair few of those agent lunches, so you're probably right. I did cross a table from Ron once or twice.
The first page of artwork I can remember from Ron, though, definitely had Dredd standing on the walls of Megacity.
Yeah.
That's probably the first story, isn't it? I can't remember what the story was, but that's the first image I can remember distinctly.
Yeah, and as you say, it was quite an American DC comic kind of powerful dynamic pose, wasn't it?
Yeah, but with more detail in the backgrounds and the city. I mean, the cityscapes are fantastic. They were different to Mickey's, different to Carlos's, but they were fantastic. It was they were more sort of his cityscapes more Blade Runner than Barcelona, really, weren't they?
Yeah, he took his time on those. Yeah, he enjoyed that.
One of the things I always remember about Ron's artwork was that, unlike quite a few artists, he did a lot of kind of industrial backgrounds. So there's the what's the one about the pyrokinetic?
It hasn't actually got a title on the strip, but it's known as kind of Jeeves Eyes.
Yeah, the punks who are bullying him into using his powers sort of take him out to this big kind of industrial wasteland and have him blow something up, and it always struck me, because no other artist really did that. They'd show the big city blocks and that would be it. There wouldn't be that kind of difference of urban environment between the industrial and you know.
Yeah I mean, they're making blow up a methane tank, so you've got that whole page splash of this tank exploding, and then all the fireball rolling across the sector and all these people running from it and on flames and stuff like that. And it's a huge amount of detail in it. And that story was in like a couple of issues after I started reading 2000 AD and used to sort of pour over that page.
Didn't he train as an engineer originally?
Well, his dad was an engineer, and Ron wanted to go to art college and was apparently told that's not what proper people do. I mean, bear in mind, I mean, this was the 1930s, so he was things weren't as economically great as they would like.
Technical drawing, hadn't he? Because it's technical drawing and his perspective and everything was spot on always.
Exactly.
And he writes exactly about the industrial and engineering sort of backgrounds and things. They're always plausible. They always work, didn't they?
Absolutely. And it's interesting. It's one of those classic sort of stories of the 1940s, is that if it weren't for the war, if it weren't for joining up, Ron's life would have been very, very different. He'd probably just gone into engineering like his dad.
Sure, that's possible. The other artist, of course, that was active during the war was Eric Bradbury. He was actually the tail gunner in a bomber, which always found quite astonishing. So, yeah, no, so maybe their paths almost crossed, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the, it's been one of the interesting reactions to the obituaries is people go, oh, I can't believe that, you know, he actually flew in the Second World War. And I mean, we were working out and he must have only just sort of joined up at the end of the war.
Yeah, well, there's, according to John Freeman, he said he trained during the Second World War and then flew Spitfires over Europe after the war.
Yeah.
So he was only sort of like about 18 or so when he started flying these Spitfires. Well, I don't think he was actually engaged in dogfights or anything.
Well, he kept the moustache, didn't he, anyway?
Steve, I want to come to you, because as Tharg, during that kind of golden heyday of the 1980s, there was such a difference in styles on Judge Dredd. So as I said, you know, you had your Mick McMahon, you had your Bolland, you had various other sort of older artists, so people like John Cooper and Ron. But was this intentional that you kept this variety of different artists on, or was it purely practical because you had just so much product to actually put out on a regular basis?
Yeah, it was expediency, purely practical. If Dredd is 6 pages a week, you're going to need more than one artist. What I liked about Ron's contribution to that was his villains and his sort of comedic characters, like Citizen Snork, Gabriel, and Bang. That's where I think he really scored. I don't know what Robin thinks.
Yeah, I know, the grotesques and the ugly, they're fantastic, absolutely. Absolutely, anything like that. It's the thing, yeah, exactly, when he got the opportunity to run with something like that, he really obviously enjoyed it, you could tell, couldn't you?
Yeah.
So he told me, it's interesting, because he told me how he worked, and I can't not believe it, because he told me, but back into what he used to do was...
The alarm clock,
yeah, and it's that thing. Steve's had the same thing, which is, he used to set an alarm clock for so many hours. I can't work out how many hours it would have been, but a set number of hours. He'd work on a page. When the alarm clock went off, he'd put that page to one side and start on the next. Finish, go through the pages like that. Then he would go back to the start and work through them. And I think that's where you got that layers, and that's why you ended up with that detail on the pages, because he built them up gradually, but then they were always going to be finished artwork.
Yeah. I was just going to say, he shared the same agent as Mick McMahon. i.e. Temple Agency. And I remember the agent, Pat Kelleher was his name, came in and said Ron wanted a £10 a page rise. And I, for some reason, I said, okay. Well, of course, this didn't go down too well with Mick. I don't think he was so much cross with us as with his agent, stiffing him behind, you know.
Yeah. Especially as Mick used to bring his artwork in himself anyway, so the agent didn't have to do anything.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't know if you remember this. He'd said when he started working for DC Thompson, he'd sent in some samples, and they invited him up to the office. And they said, could you just go in the room? They didn't actually believe he'd drawn the samples he'd sent in. Wow. So they shut him in a room with paper and pen and said, we'll draw it again, which is what he claims he did. And obviously they then employed him. But on the subject of pay rises, he said he was always hoping for a pay rise from DC Thompson. And every Christmas, the managing editor would call him into the room and he'd say, that's been another great year, Ron. Thanks for your contribution and things. And Ron would be going, oh, I've got small children. I could probably do with a pay rise. And they'd give him a golf club again.
Well, he always was quite, I don't know, he wasn't scathing about his time at DC Thompson, but he doesn't hold back on his opinion of the way, because it was very different to somewhere like IPC. It was all these wartime, you know, people who'd, they're all veterans, they'd all fought during the war, and they all had their little... offices, and they never talked to each other. So if you were seen talking to a member of staff from another office, and you'd be called in and hauled over the coals. And there was such a kind of weird patriarchal hierarchy to the whole thing that I think he found amusing more than anything else. So he said to me, when I interviewed him years ago, he said it was a relief to go fully freelance because all of a sudden I didn't have to deal with all this stuff because I had agents who would, you know, deal with the negotiations and the artwork and everything.
Well, I think Steve would tell you, because I'm too young for this, because when I started work, it had become IPC, but Steve worked, I think, for Fleetway. But Fleetway was very much the same as Thompson's. Mm. There was lots of war veterans. There was, I think, Jack LeGrand was the managing editor, you know, Steve. And all these, lots of these guys have been in the forces, and there were the management of what became IPC. So I think probably it's just that IPC had modernized slightly because it took on, was it Fleetway and Oddams and whatever else became IPC. So I think it wasn't much different there. It was just times changed for in London, but not very much in Dundee.
Well, it's all in my amazing memoir, The Mikey One. My
Yes, I bought it.
But you're right. It was a nostalgic times.
And Steve, from your perspective as editor, what was the different reaction to the different artists? You know, were there readers who had a strong reaction to Ron's stuff? You know, did he have his lovers and his haters kind of thing, or was it a more general reaction people had to the strip?
I'm not sure. Maybe the younger readers went for his style more readily because it was more kind of digestible.
Mm.
But beyond that, I don't really know, Mike. Sorry.
there wasn't sort of comic fandom. So the feedback you get from the kids was basically wanted a post order and they'd like the characters, they'd like the stories.
Yeah.
They weren't fussed about the rest of it. Obviously, when you meet them when they grow up, they go, oh, I really liked Brian's stuff or Mick's stuff or Dave's stuff. They say it later. But at the time, remember, it was like you're getting a comic out every week. The letters from the kids are something you fill up the nerve center with. And you know what I mean? There wasn't really an opinion that you could take on board at that point because comic fans weren't comic fans like obviously they became.
Mm.
Yeah.
And with an artist like Ron, when you tally up the sheer amount of pages that he did, so not just on the main strip, but also he did the Daily Star strip for many years, that makes him, I think, more prolific than even Carlos went on to become.
Massimo as well, remember, used to turn it in.
Yeah. The same, right? And is that testament to editorial being able to trust him to turn the pages in on time?
Oh yeah, he was a lifeboat in a stormy sea sometimes, you know, just we're drowning, call for Ron.
No, he could keep it. No, the thing is, if you do it really and honestly, if it hadn't been for Ron, if you look at the sheer number of pages, we never missed an issue, but I think we might well have done if it hadn't been for Ron being able to do it. Because, you know, if you look at those scripts, there's a lot in those scripts. It's a hard thing to do. There's a lot just for drawing Judge Dredd. There's a lot of detail, there's everything. And lots of people just can't do it at the rate he could do it. Mm. And that's the, you know, that's experience, age, and professionalism that he had on his side. I mean, you talk about the older guys that worked for 2000, and I'm pretty sure it was John Cooper that came and wanted to do a job once because he wanted to have his E-Type Jaguar upholstered.
I must say, I think Ron's best work was on the infamous Blood of Satan. Remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, infamous. It's very good.
I was looking at some last night, actually, because I've forgotten how much the Judge Charlie did and things. It's because you forget. It's like because he came like fractionally later. You forget how long he was actually there for, don't you, until you start looking back to how long he actually worked on 2004.
Yeah, he did loads of Judge Child, didn't he?
Yeah.
God, he did, yeah.
The thing is, though, nobody ever worried. apart from the you know, Brian and Mickey and Caligula and John Hurt thing, nobody ever worried about continuity. But actually, even with that, nobody really worried about continuity too much, because in the end, the kids were paying, what was it, 9-10 pence for a comic, and they were happy with getting a really good story. And remember, the storylines and the characters would carry it, even if the artwork varied a little bit.
Yeah. And later, as he got his kind of found his feet, I think John and Alan would write specific stories to his kind of strengths.
Yeah.
Like Dickerson Snork or the others.
Yeah. And things with lots and lots of characters in, because he was happy doing that as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Fill place. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's one point I wanted to focus on, and this is the second time it's come up, is Ron's grasp of the grotesque, of the comically grotesque. And Matt, you know, looking back at the kind of stories that he did, you know, you're talking Otto Sump, Dave the Orangutan, Pug Ugly and the Buglies, the Stupid Gun, Citizen Snork, the Blobs. I mean, these are, when you talk to people who are reading in the 1980s about their favourite stories, these come up time and time and time again. And I do wonder whether people actually kind of make the connection that it's Ron, you know, the common denominator of all these funny stories, the defining stories, is Ron Smith.
Yeah. It's kind of like when people say about good lettering, you know, you shouldn't notice it. Mm. You should just read it, not taking notice. And Ron's kind of like so solid and professional that you forget how important he was to the comic. Mm. Kind of like it's sort of like this. He was kind of one of these guys that's propping it up, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think. He was definitely adept at doing these citizen stories and these stories about the character of the city and the people that lived in it, and that was really his forte. And while the epics tend to get the most praise and often the most kind of like the headlines, you know, like the Apocalypse War or Necropolis or whatever, it's often the little stories that was just as important in establishing the strip and the character Judge Dredd, and things like Blobs or the Weatherman. That was one of Ron's as well, wasn't it? Mm. The composer that brings the house down. Now, just these little one-off stories, but they're so important in establishing the city and just making it what it is. Mm. And I think he was great at that.
It's when that's where the humour got in, because you could have several years worth of the Apocalypse War, as I seem to remember it, for a joke at the end of it, whereas the one-offs, you're right, or two-parters, they were the ones that actually delighted everybody.
Mm. Well, that's it. You, as you say, you have the Apocalypse War, and then you have the League of Fatties, which is a you know, when you drill down into it, it's not laughing at obese people, it's actually revealing how horribly cruel this world is. You know, there's a real pathos to all of the fatty stories. But, you know, these people who are so universally bored because they've got nothing to live for, that they just eat. And then the state comes along and herds them into concentration camps for the audacity of saying, well, I'm hungry, you know, you need to feed
me. Money to mobile home, what you expect.
Exactly. Steve, what was, I can't remember whether it was you or Robert mentioned about John and Alan starting to write for Ron because they knew he could do the comedy. What do you think of the key things that Ron always brought to a strip that he was given?
Well, just what I said, these amazing sort of, what Matt Smith said, citizens, these crazy citizens. So he could do comedy quite well in a kind of straight way. We had an artist called Casanovas who was very comical in style. But Ron could take a pinch of that and drop it into Mega City One, and it just seemed to gel nicely. I'm just thinking now of the very first picture in Chopper, where not so much his thing of Chopper, but Chopper's dad hanging out from a window, dressed as some kind of bat or something.
He was heading eggs into a bucket, wasn't he?
can you remember that?
Yes, yeah.
His dad was trying to head as many eggs into a bucket as he could when his mum was a competitive washer-upper. That was yeah. That was what they had in life. That was the goals.
What did his mum do?
She washed up repeatedly.
She washed up.
Oh, Steve, where do you think this came from, though? Because, you know, Ron was a lovely chap. He was very avuncular, very nice, but always seemed quite straight-laced. And yet you've got this grotesque humour. He ended up doing album covers for heavy metal bands he was one of the artists that when people talk about the punk element in Judge Dredd, I always feel like they're talking about Ron Smith stuff, which is this weird contrast between what's on the page and the guy who was actually drawing it. Where do you think that came from?
Well, I think Robin would probably answer that better. I think the answer is that Ron, whatever brief you gave him, he was talented enough to kind of fuse his talents.
You're exactly right, but I think Ron, being a bit older though, could look at what had gone on. I mean, the punk stuff, Susanna would, you know, you'd have to credit Brent Brendan with starting a lot of that off, and then Mickey as well. But Ron obviously looked at what had gone before and thought, oh, this is fantastic. I've got free rein here. I can, you know, obviously, like lots of comic artists, there's the bit where he could have ended up doing funny strips instead. And so there's the opportunity to get that sort of humour into it, but draw it properly, draw it realistically. Absolutely that. Yeah, exactly right.
I always think there's an element in what Ron did of your kind of Leo Baxendale, Ken Reed, that kind of, you know, the traditional British grotesque in comic books, but translated into a sci-fi world.
Yeah,
perfect. Yeah,
especially again with both detail and things, but also he would have been working with Leo Baxendale definitely in Dundee anyway, wouldn't he? He worked for DC Thompson's there.
Yeah.
Those guys all started in Scotland and moved down, didn't they?
Well, it makes you wonder how Mike Weston might have approached Judge Dredd, you know, because he could do the humour and the straight stuff. And he would have had that perspective that Ron had, of being a bit older.
Well, it's funny we never got him to have a go at it, actually, isn't it? Because he worked for Eagle, didn't he?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
When I worked for Eagle, he was working for Eagle still, so... Yeah, that's a very fair point. Actually, probably we just didn't get around to it.
Yeah. Well, we had Eric, didn't we? So Eric Bradbury.
Well, Eric Bradbury's another guy totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Okay. How did he do it? You know, it was from something completely different. Managed to do it fantastically. I think it's just when it came to it, the guys that hadn't drawn something like Judge Dredd really wanted to go at it, because it looks like, you know, if you're an artist, it looks like a lot of fun is the thing, isn't it? If you've been drawing, say, old adventure stuff or aeroplanes or you like and things, what a fantastic thing to have a go at.
Yeah. How often do you get to draw a character who carries his nose around in a wheelbarrow?
Well, let's not be personal, shall we?
One of the things I wanted to explore, and I'll start off talking to you about this, Matt, is when people name the top sort of five Judge Dredd artists, as we said, there's always Mick, there's always Brian, Steve Dillon, you know, people like that. And so often I feel like Ron Smith isn't on that kind of list. And we've sort of touched on that already about how because he was ubiquitous quite often. You know, there'll be weeks and weeks of this stuff and it would all be brilliant, but you barely notice him. Do you think his contribution to Judge Dredd does easily get overlooked?
I think so. I think maybe the skill that was there wasn't possibly appreciated at the time by the readership. But as Robin was saying, you know, you were dealing with, you know, for the most part, 8-year-old kids that were just reading it for the stories and weren't really necessarily paying real attention to the artwork. But I think with so many of the artists that really stand out from 2008, they were very much bringing a modern sensibility to comics. I think with Brian's artwork, I think he was really, but certainly by the sort of the Judge Death and Judge Death Lives, he was bringing a really bold, dynamic style to 2000D that a lot of maybe people, you know, comic readers and British comic readers hadn't really seen before.
Mm.
And Mick was kind of like reinventing the wheel when he was on Slane, changing his style, and Carlos was bringing the European sensibility to his work, and possibly Ron still belonged to a slightly older tradition because he came up through these humor titles that his work felt like it was slightly of an older age, but no less, you know, no. Not worse for that, but maybe it wasn't appreciated at the time for how good he was at storytelling and how strong his inks were, and that may have been why he slightly drifted away from Dread by the time he got to sort of like the late 80s. His style wasn't felt he was keeping up with a change in tastes and the evolving comic.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what's your take? Do you think Ron was overlooked
at the time? You mean?
No, I think it's more a kind of legacy question. You know, when people are thinking about the great Judge Dredd artists, obviously there's people like Carlos and whatnot, but that sometimes people tend to say, "Oh yes," and there's Ron Smith, and yet his contribution was so huge.
Yeah. Tricky. I just return to my point that I think no one did a better sort of citizen than him, you know, and his villains. I think that his Dread, it might be that his Dread was never quite, it was slightly American. And that might be why people don't rate him in the top four.
Oh, that's interesting because he did do quite a lithe, Judge, you know, he was muscular, but he was athletic, and there's a long-standing joke about Ron Smith's beautifully bottomed Dread. I mean, just to explore that point about it being quite American. I mean, I suppose you, I don't know, could you see hints of like Neil Adams, people like that in his stuff, that kind of very athletic?
No, there's definitely the occasional hint. I could say that.
And yeah. I mean, Robin, what's your take on it?
Well, I think the thing is, as you've both been saying, which is by the time people started considering which are the best artists on something that happened a long time ago, they've become slightly more grown up and sophisticated comic fans. And so you look at Brian's stuff, particularly the Judge Dredd stuff, and look, that was the first thing that was ever reprinted, and it was reprinted over and over again. Mickey's stuff is unique. Carlos is obviously, you know, set a whole new sort of style and everything. But I think it's the fact that Ron kept it going the rest of the time. And I think what it was is when you got something different, when somebody else did it, you kind of, it just made a change.
Mm.
And Ron was the guy that did it week in, week out. And I think you're right about it bringing some of the previous generation of artists to it, because you could imagine Ron drawing for Valiant quite easily. I mean, you know, because he could match that sort of style, or you could imagine him drawing war comics all the time. But it's the fact that he could bring proper black and white drawing to 2000 AD, because that's obviously, remember, it was always black and white. It always was, you wanted it to look full. You wanted it to look as, you know, you wanted as much of it drawn. You couldn't do it as American style, which would be your outline for color. He put the detail in. And I think possibly, if you went by the number of kids that would do copies of his drawings, which is how you judged which the kids liked, lots of the kids would draw Ron characters and send in their drawings for possible inclusion in the comic. So, you know, I think he was rated at the time. I think probably it's just with a more sophisticated audience for reprints, it's been a bit forgotten about, but I'm sure this is a, you know, thing that will change.
Mm. It's certainly been interesting since the news about his passing away came out, just seeing how many people have mentioned a favorite moment of Ron Smith's stuff. So yeah. Even though he might not necessarily, you know, feature on their top artist list, the impact is still there. The characters are still there, and it's always all about the characters, isn't it, Matt? The kind of it, you know, you talk about Carlos and you talk about epics. So you say the Apocalypse War or Necropolis or something like that. But with Ron, it's individual characters.
Yeah, He was he was the master of coming up with a unique looking character. Captain Skank, to pluck another one out of the air from Pirates of the Black Atlantic, you know. Fabulous character, villain. Yeah. He could come up with anything. He had a great imagination on it.
Mm. I'm thinking Otto Sump. He did originally do Otto Sump,
Thinking
of a particular image of Otto Sump with the, what can I say, postulating. That's the only way you can describe it, really.
But I mean, that's a classic example of John and Alan with Ron coming up with a character, and then after the initial story, thinking, there's a bit more to this. you've got that original sob story, and then Otto Sump becomes this massive thing, and you know, it was interesting when the second Dread movie came out. One of the criticisms that some people had for it was that. There wasn't enough of that crazy, of that madness. And Otto Sump keeps coming up time and time. You know, where are the ugly clinics? You know, where are the uglies? So it's weird that you know, he had such an influence on this world.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah. very much kind of mid-80s kind of punk. The way 2000.
If you took out everything that Ron did do, actually, there's quite a lot missing, isn't there? You're right.
Mm. Yeah, it's a profound effect, and I think it's because every artist who's worked on Dread has brought something to the table. With Ron, I mean, I'll put this out there, tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think anyone has had such an influence on the kind of the kind of street level, you know, the citizens of 2008. Is there another artist that's had such a profound effect on the way that we view, not the judges, but the actual citizenry?
I say Mick and Carlos are both very good at doing that street level character. Mm. You look at some of Mick's early work around sort of like or Agrodome, or you know, around Monkey Business at Charles Darwin Block. Mm-hmm. You know, those sort of stories. He was very good at drawing like little individual characters in a crowd. And Carlos was great at coming up with cool looking characters in stories like The Execution or the one about the rad mutant at Christmas.
Night of the Rad Beast.
Again, sort of lots of crowds, but individual characters that you could pick out. Mm. But Ron was very good at bringing out memorable characters. I think that was his forte. You can vividly remember his punks and his uglies. He was up there with doing the citizens.
There was a travelling exhibition, I mean, we're talking sort of 15 years ago now, of 2008 artwork that went to various places around the country. And there was a page from the Captain Skank story, Pirates of the Black Atlantic, I think it was that one, where it shows this kind of, this sailing ship. It looks like an old schooner, but the sail is a massive kind of solar sail. Mm. And the nice thing about that exhibition was you could get right up close, like millimetres away from the artwork, behind protective glass, obviously. But the sheer precision of Ron's work on that page was incredible.
Mm.
You know, because we kind of... I think the art of inking is often overlooked in comics, particularly in British comics, where it is lumped in with the pencil, you know, it tends to be an artist who does all of it. So there's not that separation you get in American comics. But Ron's inking was incredible, and he was doing that with pens and a brush.
Fine brushes. No, it's fine brush as well. But the thing is, the other thing about Ron's artwork, when you look at it, is the final pass was with white gouache.
Mm.
So there's a slight textural thing, because he would go over, once he'd done it, he would go back and put the detail and the corrections in at one go. So there'd always be lots of white paint on it, because he would then paint stuff out and go again. And that was one of the things he did. And that's a lot. When you see the, you look at the artwork again, you can see the bits that have been painted in white on it. Even when in reprint, you can see how much work is done like that. Now, it's an incredible amount of work on each page. But he must, I mean, you know, we talk about the alarm clock thing. I think it's the, it is that effort. And I don't suppose Ron ever let a page go he wasn't happy with.
No, no. I think he said when I interviewed him years ago that you know, if there was something wrong with the page, he would redo it in his own time. So you know, you had the day of work where he had the timer going, and if a page needed more or it needed redoing, he would put his girl to bed in the evening and then go up to his drawing board and do it into the wee early hours. But then he'd be up at the normal time the next day to get the kids ready for school and, you know, and then begin work again. So it was, I suppose it's that kind of work-life balance thing, is that you...
Yeah, he did well, and he managed to live to 94?
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, there's some question about how old exactly he was. But if he was flying Spitfires at the very tail end of the war, it was the early 1920s. So it's remarkable that he was able to do that. Steve, is there a favourite moment for you? I mean, we've already kind of talked a little bit about our favourite moments. Was there a favourite moment of Ron Smith for you?
Well, I'll stick with the picture of the chopper's dad. I mean, that's pure Wagner Grant. You know, you can imagine them writing that and sort of giggling, and Ron took it and made it.
Yeah.
What about you, Robin?
I can't disagree. When you come out, I was thinking of Grotesque, and now Steve's pointed that out. It's that sort of stuff that just works perfectly. It's anything that's got a belly wheel or a large proboscis. It's it's any of that.
Yeah.
It's any of that. It's anything he did, but particularly the detail on the city. Those cityscapes, as you look across the city, and it's drawn to the horizon.
Mm.
So there's no getting out of it, and it's well drawn, and it's detailed, and it works, and it's, yeah, it's just that precision I really admire.
Yeah, and it's a sci-fi landscape. I mean, I think it was you, Robin, talked about it being like Blade Runner, in that you have somehow that combination of the futuristic but grounded in a reality that everybody could recognise. So yes, his city blocks weren't Carlos and Mick sort of big mushroom style blocks,
condiments.
they were, but anyway, you know, his skyscrapers went straight up.
Yeah, it didn't look like it was pristine. He managed to get it so it looked like a mega city. He could draw scruffy well.
Matt, what's your favourite moment?
One that sticks in my mind for nostalgia reasons, but it is, as mentioned before, it's Blood of Satanas, because it was reprinted in the very first issue of Better 2000 AD Monthly, and it was on the cover as well. It was, I think it's the cover where the half human half dinosaur hybrid is trying to hang himself, and Dredge yelling Storm. It's Peters, the man who drank the blood of Satanas. And the Best of 2000 Monthly started about a couple of months after I started buying 2000 E.
Mm.
So it was really good in getting me up to speed on all these stories I've missed. And so for that reason, I mean, Blood of Satanas is a great story anyway. And a particular point, remember, where Dredd punches out this guy and says, "Suck my kid glove," because he's been told that the perp has got, like, he needs special handling, and so Dredd just punches him. But yeah, that has a special certain place in my heart.
Now, funny enough, the Best of 2008 Monthly, I think, deserves a lot of credit for exposing more people to Ron's artwork, because those early volumes of reprints, the graphic novels from the 1980s, the Titan stuff avoids a lot of the Ron stuff. It focuses on Mick and Brian and people like that. Whereas Best of 2008 AD was just filled with his... I mean, you know, it was because he was reprinting this classic stuff. Stephen Robin, with the Best of 2008 AD, tell us a little bit about where that came from, as far as you know, because it was a remarkable thing for anybody who hadn't read this stuff originally. Where did the Best of 2008 AD monthly come from? Was it an editorial direction, or was it sort of corporate, or...?
I'd gone by then, so that's it.
I think it was a corporate edict that came down from up on high and ended up with the managing editor, who came to me and said, we want to do this, because they had other best jobs at the time, I think, I don't know. And it was so easy to do. Just get the film, whack it off to the printer, and there you were. The money they must have made off that, I can't begin to imagine.
What's this film stuff, Steve, you're talking about? I don't quite get that.
Oh, it's the same as cow gum.
But my 2008 reading story is much like yours, Matt. You know, I think I mentioned it on the podcast before. My first experience of 2008 was the Best of 2008 monthly that had the first half of the VCs in it.
Right.
And smack in the middle of that was the Hot Dog Run.
Oh, yeah.
And I still maintain that is... it's overshadowed because the Apocalypse War comes quite soon afterwards. I think the Hot Dog Run is one of the best Judge Dredd stories, just because of the sheer amount of world building and detail. I mean, there's stuff in there that absolutely blew my tiny mind. It was quite tiny. It explored the cursed earth in a way that I think an awful lot of other stories have struggled to explore the cursed earth. And a lot of that was to do with, you know, the script is pure John and Alan, but so much of the built environment and the natural environment comes out of Ron's imagination. You know, I used to have nightmares about the Gilamunja, you know, crawling over my bedroom ceiling. And what was the main guy in that? Scabby Hayes, the mutant leader. It's just wonderful, wonderful stuff. In fact,
I think he's still alive and wandering the streets of Glasgow.
It shows that John grew up with cowboy films, doesn't it? The Gabby Hayes. Well, yeah, Hayes.
Exactly. There's a wonderful frame in that, though, which I think is pure Ron Smith, which is where the mutant gang have raided a Munt's farm, and they've taken everybody by surprise, and they burst into the dormitory of where the Munt's farmers are staying, and Scabby Hayes shoots one of the Munt's farmers as he's trying to put his trousers on, and the line is something like, you know, don't get up, or you know, don't get up, Norm, or something like that. And that for me is pure Ron Smith. A horrific moment of comedy, you know, somebody is shot, and not just this is one of the things, talking about how Ron drew gritty, he also drew gore quite nicely as well, because he doesn't hide the bullet that goes through the guy putting his trousers on, like it literally bursts out of him. Go on, Robin.
I was going to say, take it from the start, you could draw a man standing up and pulling his trousers on in a hurry as well before that happened. You know, it's being able to draw anything. I think it's that, without, you could draw everything as well as everything else. So the gore, but the humour and the, you know, trousers.
Yeah. Yeah. I on my notes, I've got the page that Ron did from The Day the Law Died, where the big bundle of judges pushes Cal out of the top of the Statue of Judgment. And it's all this stuff, Chinese the Ferg, and you've got this, all these people all drawn perfectly. And then right in the bottom corner, you've got splat. Which is just, you know, even in that moment, there's like, you know, the ignominious end of Cal the Tyrant, you know, just splat.
Is that a Ron splat, or is that a Tom splat?
I think, by the looks of things, that is a Ron splat. Because
it was incorporated.
Yes, yeah. It's wonderful, wonderful. I mean, just on a final point, what do we feel is the legacy? Because the whole conversation's been about the legacy of Ron Smith. What would you say is the ongoing legacy of Ron Smith? Matt, I'll come to you first.
He's been instrumental for building Judge Dredd and the Judge Dredd strip into what we remember it today. Mm. I think, you know, everybody who picked up 2000 AD at some point in the last, back certainly between 1980 and 87 or so, they will remember Judge Dredd, and that will be partly because of Ron, the city that Ron drew. Mm. So I think he's definitely should be remembered as somebody who helped build the Judge Dredd strip for what we know it today.
Mm. And we haven't even moved on to the other stuff that he did.
No. I mean, I'd be interested to know from Steve why Ron kind of moved away from Dredd in sort of about 87. He kind of stopped drawing it for a bit.
Was I editing it then, or was David Bishop?
It would have been Richard Burton maybe possibly taking over by then, Simon Gill.
Well, Richard was a big fan of Ron, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Perhaps because Carlos had come back to it, and there was panel, lots of artwork, couldn't he? So
there wasn't much space for Ron to... Yeah, that would be it.
Yeah. Okay. Steve, what do you think is the legacy of Ron's work for 2000 AD?
Well, within the context of 2000 AD, I'd say it was, as Matt put it, I couldn't really improve on that. But I would hope, as an artist per se, there would be a wider appreciation. The same for Carlos and others who have gone. Perhaps the Cartoon Museum in London can sort of figure something out on that, you know.
Absolutely. That would be lovely to see a sense of the sheer breadth of what he did. I mean, like I said at the top of the show, you're talking about a career that was 50 years long. I mean, the world was a completely different place from when he started.
Can you remember, though, that, of course, because of the newspaper strip, Ron's version of Dredd is the one that took Dredd to the much wider public?
Absolutely.
So that's, you know, that's how lots of people that aren't comic readers, per se, know Judge Dredd from having seen that.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, Steve.
That would explain his absence from the Weekly if he's drawing the Danny Star strip.
Hmm. And it is, I mean, that alone, we could probably have an entire podcast episode on. The big achievement of that was compressing with John and Alan the Apocalypse War down into 9 panels. And it's interesting how the ending of the newspaper strip is the one that people remember. That line about, we'll get our retaliation in first.
Next time.
Next time. It's from the newspaper strip. It's not from the main strip. Yeah, just absolutely incredible. We've been going for an hour. Like I said, I could talk about Ron's work and what an incredible loss he is for hours and hours and hours. But thank you so much to Steve, to Robin and to Matt for your thoughts and feelings and memories about working with Ron Smith.
Yeah. You're welcome. But I'd just like to say before you go, I did once get his tax bill. I swear, no, absolutely true. And I had to submit my income tax and my revenue again to prove I wasn't Ron Smith. I wish at the time, but yeah.
On that note.
Yeah, thank you.
Fantastic. Bye. Thank you so much, guys.
That's great. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, thank you again to Matt, to Robin and to Steve for some lovely memories and thoughts on the work and legacy of Ron Smith. Our most sincere condolences go out to Ron's family at this very sad time. But what an incredible legacy of artwork, some incredible moments in the history of Judge Dredd, 2000 AD and British comics. Rest in peace, Ron. You are very sorely missed.